www.ccrc.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After two tours in Afghanistan, you would think that eight-year Marine Corps infantry veteran Rob Bates would be through with that war-torn nation. But last month, he returned, not as a soldier, but as a combat artist. That got our attention. In this age of instant digital photography, what can an artist add to the documentation of a war zone? How does an artist whose work takes considerably more time, concentration, and effort than that of a photographer stay safe while he draws? And what happens to the pictures after they're finished? Those were just some of the questions we pondered, and to get the answers, we asked Rob Bates to join us, and he's with us for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mike.
I know that you're an old pro at this because you were did a series of programs with Dick Gordon, the story with Dick Gordon on public radio from WUNC in Chapel Hill, and now we have a shot at you. You had a big display at UNC Charlotte, which we'll talk about last summer because it's coming back again this spring at CPCC. But you began drawing combat pictures in 2004, is that right?
2004, 2008, and 2009.
How did it start?
In 2004, I was a fire team leader attached to 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, and we were in Afghanistan, and we were on a company-sized patrol approaching a village. And on the radio, they called for someone who had some talent to go up on top of a mountain, overlook a village, and sketch it. At the time, we were so Spartan, we didn't have FOBs established yet. Still very early in the war.
What's a FOB?
Forward Operating Bases.
Okay.
And we were still very early in the war. And so we didn't have the luxury of having a laptop to plug into a generator and to transfer images from a digital camera. So I said, I can do it. And I climbed up top of a very tall mountain and got some paper and started sketching the layout of some compounds. Well, lo and behold, I did this about 13 different times aside from my job. And I would actually go down to a makeshift COC, which is Command Operations Center, where the company commander would sit at. And I would pretty much enlarge on a very large piece of plywood with terrain features, etc. It was more used for tactical purposes. Well, I don't know where those drawings are today, but that's kind of where it started. I got out for about a few years, came back in, and then I really started delving into combat art.
So you left the military for a couple of years, came back in, and that's what happened? That's how your art career, I guess, began to expand?
Yes, exactly.
When they asked for volunteers and you said, I can do it, how did you know you could do it? What was your past experience with a pencil and a piece of paper?
Well, it's going to sound very cliche, but I've been drawing since I was about two,
okay,
since I was able to pick up a crayon. So that's just been something that's always been a passion of mine, was drawing and art in general. So I had a lot of confidence in myself, and it turned out it helped the company out. We would use these layouts as ways to separate compounds and platoons in the company to search certain compounds, compound A, B, C, mm-hmm. D, etc. And so did a good job with it, and it worked out to our advantage.
And you stepped up your drawing, the need for your drawing, while deployed in, what, Helmand province in Afghanistan in 2008 and 9, is that right?
That's correct.
And the military commander there asked you to draw again.
No, they actually didn't ask me to draw.
Oh.
I brought a sketch pad with me, a 6x10 book, and I had no idea why I did it. I just wanted to document the human experience at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I brought this book with me, and I started sketching at the airport, and then when we got to Kyrgyzstan before we went to Afghanistan, and I had no idea what I was going to do with this book. I just took it with me, had some pens, and I went to work, and then as the days dragged on and things started happening, we started getting hit with improvised explosive devices. I started sketching the destroyed Humvees, gun trucks,
right,
the people, the emotions, Marines standing the posts. And it became a hit. And even then, I had no idea what I was going to do with this book.
Hmm. And to this point, when you were doing all this, you were self-taught.
Self-taught. Well, I did take a distance education training council course, art instruction schools. I don't know if people have really ever seen the commercial where draw the turtle and the pirate. And, well, I did that in high school, and I finished it up after I got out the first time.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you learn some stuff there, but it's really self. You have to be self-motivated, a consummate self-starter.
What interested you? What kinds of things when you were in this situation and you brought this sketchbook over that you didn't know what you were going to do with? What kinds of scenes interested you, and how did you know where to focus the attention, where you should be versus what you were drawing, the angles, et cetera? How did you know?
Oh, God, it's very instinctive, really, as an artist. You just sort of know. Mm-hmm. Something that can't really, I guess it can be taught, but it's, for me, it was never taught. I just knew what to capture at that moment. It just felt right. I would sit there and my driver who was with me, my Humvee was struck by an improvised explosive device. And actually tomorrow will be 10, 11, be like the 4-year anniversary mm-hmm. of the day I dodged death. And we, about several hours after we came back to the combat outpost, I just saw the look on his face, and I started sketching him when he was on post. And I was like, well, I got to get this and get that. And I even sketched my own truck that was destroyed. And I felt it was an important piece of documentation. It's very archival for American history.
You know, when you're drawing a tank or something that's been exploded, has hit an IED, and it's stationary, that's one thing. But you're talking about drawing human beings, and they never stop moving. How do you know what expression to capture, because it's constantly changing, and how do you then capture it, because it's constantly changing? And they're not facing you all the time.
Right. Well, you just be very loose and gestural and just capture the spirit of things. And believe me, my first attempt is not always a successful attempt. I've thrown away several pieces of paper that mm-hmm. just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, very instinctive. You just know. You just take a gamble, roll the dice, and hope it works.
This notebook that you were drawing in, the 6x10 sketchbook, it's now part of the permanent collection at the National Museum of the Marine Corps. How did that come about?
I met a gentleman named Michael D. Fay. He was the in-house combat artist in residence for the National Museum of the Marine Corps for 10 years. He's been in the Marine Corps for 20 of those years. And he's done several tours of Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been a phenomenal mentor. I contacted him through his blog called Fire and Ice about 2010. And I wanted to take up that position in the Marine Corps Museum. He just retired. He saw my work, gave me some pointers, saw the sketchbook that I had. He said, the folks at the museum will probably love this, along with a few other drawings that I did. He took it to the museum. 4 months later, April 2011, my work was accessioned into their permanent combat art collection.
What did he say to you about your work?
Well, at first he said you work a little tight.
Meaning?
Photorealistic. You know, he said the key thing is when someone looks at your work, they want to be able to see just as much about the artist as the work itself. Everyone has a signature look. Mine was very photorealistic, which is great. But if you look at a work on a wall and you get four different pieces of photorealistic work on a wall, I mean, are you going to be able to tell the difference between what artist is what? So, you know, is that's a Rob Bates, or is that a Mike Fay, or is that a Chris Battles, or whatever? I could be able to tell which one, separate the four, because mm-hmm. they're so photorealistic. And he said, loosen up a little bit. That's great if that's the aim that you're going for. But, you know, loosen up, show your signature style.
Did you know what your signature was at the time?
No.
Have you found it?
I think I have. I think I'm in the process of finding it.
How would you describe it?
I don't know. I'm really
okay.
Not sure.
All right. That's all right. I'm looking at a piece of work here, just a tiny little, I'm sure it's much bigger in real life. It's called Paranoid Eyes.
Oh, yeah.
When I looked at it at first, I thought it was a photograph. And it seems to me that doing something that well, that detailed, that amazingly realistic, is much harder than opening up your style, loosening up, as Michael Fay told you, and becoming what I would consider to be a sketch artist, where you're not filling in every detail. You're leaving open spaces to, I guess that's what he meant by opening up, to the imagination.
Right.
Why is that more valuable, more interesting for the viewer than this? Because this, to me, is astounding.
I don't know if I would say it's more valuable, but it has its own value in its own way. Photorealistic work is great because it does wow the viewer. It's something that not everybody can do. Being loose and gestural, you do capture the spirit of things, mm-hmm. and you do leave room for the imagination, I guess. The eye will automatically fill in places that's not filled in physically in the work.
And as I looked at this piece, and there are others like it, but as I looked at and the piece we're talking about, you've got a soldier on his stomach with a rifle out in front of him. He's on a rock, and behind him is another soldier on his hands and knees looking out, wearing glasses, just a young guy. He looks like a kid.
Right.
And I thought, when I looked at it, I thought, you know, this same picture could have been caught by a camera in an instant. It took you much longer than an instant to make this happen. So it made me think how the military values these versus photographs, how we should value these versus photographs. What's your thought on that?
Well, photographs are great. I won't ever knock photography because they're very important to our history. However, I do think that art has its own place as well. It's, again, very expressionistic. It leaves room for the imagination. What it is, you look at something through the eye of an artist. You're looking at something drawn that the artist actually saw. Photo will give you, you get what you get. It is what you see.
Mm-hmm.
However, drawing, you know, it could be anything. Illustrators have the option of adding or subtracting, but you're looking at, in the moment, what the artist actually saw. So I think that's very important for history.
And when I'm looking at this, I was wondering how much detail you actually went into, because when you look at the soldier and his equipment and the guy behind him and the rock and this little weed growing up from the rocks, it looks very detailed. But there is a chance that you left some things out that would have obscured. A photograph may have been obscured by some of the things that you left out, or that you emphasized maybe brings out more of what the photograph would not have brought out.
Right. Well, right. Yeah, it was based off a photograph. That work was done from a photograph.
Okay.
And if you look, there's a part of the rock where if you look at a shadowy figure on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can see him, but he's kind of like hunched under a rock in the very distant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he wasn't silhouetted in a photograph, but I chose to silhouette him because I didn't want emphasis to be on him.
That was going to be one of my questions, too. How many of these, in situations where you're in a combat zone where your life is in danger because people are shooting at you, and we'll talk about this in a second. You went back in December not as a soldier, so you didn't have a rifle. Do you always draw from life, or do you take pictures and go back and sketch them in later because it's safer?
I do both. I do both. And again, it's very instinctive. You have to know when to do it, when to pull the camera out, when to pull the sketch pad out. On patrol, if you're walking, you can't slow down the patrol.
Mm-hmm.
Take a seat on a nice comfy rock bed and tell everyone to stop for a minute and let me draw you. It's you sometimes have to cut your losses and use a camera. But then again, you don't want to draw exactly from the photograph. That's what I learned this last time around. I forced myself to work loose by working on the back of the small screen on the back of my camera instead of on a laptop. I just zoomed in a little bit. I did that while in country. A lot of times, if things are pretty stationary, guys are just standing guard, or they're getting ready to mount up for a patrol, and you just want to capture something really fast, or maybe you want to capture like a post or a scene, that's also a great time to take out your sketch pad and start sketching.
Rob Bates is our guest, a former Marine Corps infantryman, and now a combat artist, or was a combat artist recently, and I guess I'll just call him an artist now because he's no longer necessarily doing just combat
right
pictures. Yeah. We're going to come back, talk more about his time in the Marine Corps, more about his work as a combat artist, and what distinguishes it, and more. So stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 regional hospitals and thousands of local patients. Every drop stays here, saving local lives. Info about sponsoring a drive at cbcc.us. And from UNC Charlotte Department of Theater, presenting Romeo and Juliet, April 12th through the 21st at Robinson Hall for the Performing Arts. Tickets and information at theater.uncc.edu. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, some see retirement from their careers as a time to relax and play golf or indulge the interests they've been putting on a back burner. But many people, either because they want to or because economically they have to, are embarking on what's being called second act careers. We'll talk about what could be the best of all possible retirement options when Charlotte Talks Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Connecticut passes strict new gun laws. Defense Secretary Hagel tells the Pentagon to brace for spending cuts. And the latest unemployment numbers.
That's the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio, or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rob Bates is our guest, a Marine Corps infantry veteran and combat artist. Rob will join Central Piedmont Community College's Arts Festival, Sensoria, to speak with students about his experience as a Marine, embedded illustrator, and the work of the Joe Bonham Project. The exhibit will run April 15th through the 23rd at CPCC's Overcash Center, with a lecture on April 17th at 10:30 in Tate Hall and a panel discussion on April 20th in Bryant Hall. You can find all the details about that and see some of Rob's work at our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. Michael Fay, you mentioned him. He's a combat artist, a well-known combat artist in the military. Encouraged you to open up a bit and also to make your art public. He thought it was good enough that it should be displayed and got you involved in the Joe Bonham Project. Talk about Joe Bonham and the purpose of that project, I guess, is what it's called.
Well, Mike Fay is the creator of the Joe Bonham Project. Joe Bonham is a central character in a 1938 Dalton Trumbo novel titled Johnny Got His Gun. And it's about a World War I soldier who takes a direct hit from a German artillery shell and loses his arms, legs, his ability to speak, see, smell, etc. Keep in mind, this is fictitious. Mm-hmm. The only way he learned how to knows how to communicate is through Morse code, and he taps his head on a pillow. His wishes were to be toured around the country to show America the rigors of war. His request was denied, and the ending wasn't so great for Joe Bonham. Well, the purpose of the Joe Bonham Project is to never allow this to happen to today's Joe Bonhams. And so we visit hospitals such as Walter Reed, Bethesda, different VA clinics, Wounded Warrior battalions all along the U.S., mainly the Eastern Seaboard. It's a group of illustrators. It's an international society of war artists, and the Society of Illustrators in New York City have come together as a joint venture to document the struggles of these guys, the men and women coming back from war.
Hmm. As you say, you went and visited these guys. You went to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda.
That's correct.
Talked to people, spent hours getting to know them before you actually drew them. Why was it important to get to know them?
Well, we don't always have that time in the beginning. When we do, we take advantage of it. But I think it's important to get their story first and to build that relationship and connection with them. My first time was with a Marine named Corporal Matthew Bowman, who lost both of his legs above the knee from an IED blast. And we literally got there. He was there 6 days, maybe tops, from Germany. So he was fresh from the battlefield. He had bandages. He was sort of drugged up. He was missing fingers, some teeth, again, above the knee amputation. And we were there for 2 days, and that's where I met Mike Fay in person for the first time last March of 2011. Mm-hmm. I was able to speak to him, his parents, his wife. He had two kids, has a third one now. And we were able to bond in such a way where it became very comfortable and second nature for me to take out my sketch pad and just draw him while he was just talking to his wife or in physical therapy the next day. It's just very important to capture that human experience because you can see it in the artwork and the viewers who are looking at your work can see it too.
How do they feel about you drawing them? I mean, this is, I would think, the toughest time of their lives. And they're coming to grips with a lot of things that would crush a lot of people. In fact, I don't understand how many of these people want to survive after some of the things that they have been through and that they will continue to go through for the rest of their lives. And here you come as a person who wants to capture that moment. How do they react to that?
Well, they're sort of happy because somebody cares. somebody wants to come and document their story, and they're not the press, and they're not anybody else that's trying to get something for a news clip. You know, somebody's here to legitimately document their story and want to hear their story. So they're really happy about it. At first, they're not sure how to react. We always ask their permission. Can we come in and sketch you? And, you know, really over 9 times out of 10, they're, that's fine. Take my story down. They're very reserved at first. But once you start building that friendship, then they open up.
Obviously, what's happened to them is self-evident. Many veterans come back with no visible signs of harm, but who have PTSD and other problems that can last a lifetime. And I know that World War I, World War II veterans, some Vietnam veterans never, ever, 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 ever talk to anyone outside the military about what happened to them on the battlefield. Is it easier for these guys because it's evident what happened to them on the battlefield?
Talking about the ones with, like, visible wounds.
Yes.
I think so. I've talked to those with PTSD before. I deal with some of that myself. I've talked with, again, on the other broader side of the spectrum, guys with missing legs and missing eyes and stuff. And they seem pretty open about it because it is evident and we can see it. It's very visible and sort of in your face. So, yeah, I think so.
How does your PTSD manifest itself?
Well, I keep it under control. It's not like it's high functioning. I keep it under control. I don't say it's not an extreme case, but it's sort of like happened later on after, and a lot of it kind of details back to the explosion and the other explosions that I've seen.
Yeah.
But I keep it under control very well.
When you sketched Corporal Matt Bowman, who you talked about a second ago, you say that sketching him resulted in work that you find the most meaningful as an artist. Why?
Well, there's one particular sketch of Matt Bowman where he's on his back and he's doing physical therapy, literally no legs, and he has on his nubs 5 and 7 pound leg weights that encircle him. And he's sweating profusely. He's working out his legs. He's getting ready for prosthetics. And I felt that there was this level of perseverance and resiliency that he's not willing to give up just so early. Like this was like a week after he got to Bethesda. And when people, I mean, no telling at night when he's laying there by himself in the bed and no one's around him and he's looking down saying, well, you know, what has happened to me? But like when we were there, It brought goosebumps to my skin. I was like, this guy is not going to give up and woe is me and feel sorry for himself. He told me he wanted to be an air marshal. Whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. But it's just the fact this guy had such high dreams. And he was going to let something like losing legs or some teeth or some fingers get in the way of that.
Michael Fay, the artist who got you involved more deeply in this kind of work and who enlisted you for the Joe Bonham Project to go out and sketch these wounded vets, told you, don't be overly emotional, just tell the story. How do you avoid being emotional when you look at these guys and what they're going through, what they've been through, and when you yourself have gone through this and know what they went through when they were in Afghanistan or in Iraq or wherever they sustained their injury? How do you avoid the emotion? And isn't the emotion what ties the viewer to the picture?
It does. And you can be emotional, but don't get wrapped around the axle. Don't let it get in the way of what you're doing, because you're an illustrator and that's your job, is to get these stories out accurately. And emotion does feed the art. It really does. Because like when I got goosebumps, I'm sketching this guy and he's on a mat doing leg exercises, just working to get prosthetics. It's amazing, and motion does fuel the art. However, don't get so tied up in it where you don't get anything done.
You became a Marine. It's a volunteer armed services now, so you obviously made a decision that you wanted to become a Marine and join the armed forces. Why Marine Corps? Why not Air Force? Why not Navy? Why not Army, et cetera?
You know, it's funny. My dad asked me that because my dad was career Navy and my two older brothers were in the Army. So he was like really upset that nobody joined the Navy. But I don't know. I almost joined the Army in high school.
Because you picked the toughest one, didn't you?
Well, I think so. I like to think so.
That's what they always tell us.
I almost joined the Army when the Ranger program. And then this could sound really dumb, but I was at high school, my recruiter. Saw a recruiter out there, had some stickers and pencils, and he was the only one giving out free stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll take these. And then he was like, don't join the Army, join the Marines. So I went into the Marines, and I joined right before 9/11 happened, and I graduated boot camp literally 3 days after 9/11. So the whole world was turned upside down.
Did you have an aha moment? Because prior to 9/11, we were at peace with no prospects for going to war, and all of a sudden, it was quite definitely we were going someplace.
Oh, it was very strange. You left the world one way because you're literally leaving the world. You're 3 months and you're solitude, no TV, nothing, no phone calls, nothing. And all of a sudden, 3 days before you graduate, you're hearing this news about planes crashing into the tower. And you're like, holy smokes. So, yeah. And I came home for leave, my 10 days of leave, I was like, well, you know, people were coming up to me and shaking my hand and telling me thank you. And I was like, I didn't do anything. I just, you know, because I was with a recruiter at the time. But I remember being in infantry school, and I remember at the chow hall watching CNN and the invasion in Afghanistan. And I was like, man, this could be like Desert Storm, 100-hour war, and I'm never going to get my shot. And boy, was I wrong, because I didn't think it was going to last over a decade.
You wanted to go?
Oh, absolutely.
Explain that to me.
Well, you join in the infantry. They're the front lines of the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
And, why would you join the infantry if you didn't want to go and fight? Now, little did you know, and you're being so young and naive as an 18-year-old, what combat really details. But, yeah, of course, definitely.
Explain that to me. Explain that to me, that's what I meant. You wouldn't have joined the infantry if you didn't want to go and fight, because they are the tip of the sword. So you know if you're going to be deployed, you're going first. And you're probably in the most danger of anybody who goes, at least initially, because you don't know what you're up against when you first go into a combat situation. And you're going to find out. You're going to be the first to find out. Why would you want to put yourself in that situation? What is it inside you that allowed you to make that decision? It's fascinating to me.
It's very intangible. It's going to be very hard for me to explain it. But, you know, one component is you're 18 and you're just looking for some adventure overseas. Another component is you've seen movies in the past and you're like, oh, but that's probably cool. You have no idea of concept of real combat. And third, I don't know, just feel like a sense of duty. And I felt like if you're going to join the Marine Corps, join the front lines, get up there.
And I know that they rigorously train you guys, rigorously, and get you ready for every eventuality. But can it really prepare you? Were you really prepared? When you got there and people start firing at you, I'm not sure what the question is here, but was the preparation adequate? Can it ever be adequate?
Well, the first time we started hitting IEDs, you train up for IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and you train up how to find them and how to deal with situations like that until you actually encounter one and the truck in front of you blows up or your truck blows up. You're never truly prepared, but you're as prepared as you can be going in that situation.
You said that as an 18-year-old, you don't really understand what combat is all about, and I think that's true of anybody who's never been in it. They can't possibly understand. And one of the things about the Joe Bonham Project, I would assume, is to make people aware of the outcomes, what the outcomes can be, not only for a nation, but for individuals involved in taking the fight to wherever it is. Does that reflect a switch in your attitude about combat, or just a maturation of it, or just a desire to make people understand that we just can't go out there willy-nilly and waste young people's lives at the drop of a hat, because there are consequences that we as American citizens are entirely removed from.
We get a bigger appreciation for humanity, that's for sure. It's a job that these guys are sent out to do, and they do it really well.
Yeah.
And I do think that we need to bring these guys back home. And the more you see these wounds, the more, whether it's they're invisible or that they are visible, you get a sense that maybe we should come home, and maybe, that these guys shouldn't have to be fighting anymore over there, and we should probably just pack our bags and quit the war. Mm. But these guys do go out there and fight for a cause, a genuine cause that they feel that they believe in.
But do you think, we've had these conversations with veterans in the past, particularly from Iraq and Afghanistan, and to a certain degree from Vietnam, but mostly Iraq and Afghanistan. The guys go over there, they fight, they do their tour or tours. They come back and they enroll in colleges. like yours, like UNC Charlotte. And they're around young people their age who have not had the experiences that you have had as a combat veteran. And they have trouble relating to these kids because not only have they not had your experience, the wars over the last 10 years have been relatively removed from American society. We were asked to go shopping. That's what we were asked to do to help the war effort. So we can't possibly know what you know. We can't possibly understand what you understand. How difficult is it for you to come home and be around that?
Well, the majority of my classmates are about 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
So there is a disconnect in such a way. But I don't let that get in the way of anything. I don't really talk about my experiences so much. I don't let that intrude on a friendship. They don't understand that's true. And it's not their fault. They just don't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't their time.
Should we understand more?
Yeah, which is why I've been going out there and doing combat art. I think mm-hmm. that's an important part, a valuable piece of American history. Going out there and documenting not only the war out there, but at home in these hospitals. It's a two-front war for these guys. You know, whether they're fighting out there and they come back and they're fighting a war internally or externally.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's important because you look on the news, they don't talk about the war anymore. And there is still a war going on. I was just there in December.
Right.
And before I got there, the unit that I embedded with got into a nasty ambush. They lost a guy. And it was like 3-1 odds, a platoon maybe minus like 30 guys against a Taliban force over half their size. And that's not an everyday thing, but there's still violence there, and I don't think the American people see that so much.
Rob Bates is our guest, a former Marine who has served two tours of duty in Afghanistan. And in December, you went back strictly as an artist. You were embedded with a unit, and you did not have a weapon because you were no longer in the military. I'm just curious what that was like. I mean, you're pretty defenseless without a weapon.
Well, I knew that I was going to be with Marines, so one, that was a level of comfort that I had. Two, I knew my place. I'd been there before. I knew, in a patrol, where to be,
mm-hmm.
where not to be,
mm-hmm.
the protocol.
If they got locked down in a situation, would they have tossed you a weapon?
Probably not, unless somebody went down. I'm telling you what, if somebody would have went down, I would have picked up a weapon and laid rounds down range, because
mm-hmm.
that's just what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we never got in that situation while over there.
Was it your request to go back as an embedded artist?
Yeah, it was. It was a self-fulfilling journey. I felt that I need to go one last time, and I coined it sketching the drawdown.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like my Olympics. I'm there every 4 years, 04, 08, 12. And I wanted to go and document the war. You know, everyone has their own opinion about, should we pull out, what's going on over there? And I wanted to go and see it firsthand so I can give an honest assessment, an accurate representation of what's happening.
And we'll talk about that in the next segment, I suppose. But you, as you say, you were there, you enlisted, 2001 happened, they sent you over there, then you got out of the military, and then you went back in.
Right.
What made you go back in?
The economy.
Quickly? The economy.
The economy. I was selling insurance for about a year. Mm-hmm. It was a god-awful job.
Okay. Let's stop. Let's stop right there. And we'll come back. We'll follow up on that with Rob Bates, Marine Corps combat infantry veteran and also combat artist. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Living Online, supporting Charlotte Wine and Food Weekends, Motown at Uptown, Saturday, April 20th at Founders Hall. Tickets available at charlottewineandfood.org. Coming up next at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Connecticut passes strict new gun laws. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel tells the Pentagon to brace for spending cuts, and the latest unemployment numbers are released. A panel of journalists joins guest host Susan Page for analysis of the week's top national news stories. That's at 10. We're coming right back to more conversation with Rob Bates. And a reminder, Rob will have an exhibit of his work at CPCC during their arts festival, Sensoria, April 15th through the 23rd at CPCC's Overcash Center. Details about that exhibit and a lecture and panel discussion involving Rob Bates at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
In Somalia, one unlikely refugee camp has cared for people so long that it's evolved from a safe haven to a village.
because they get used to this peace and comfort. Whenever they try to go out, they come back.
A daughter inherits a refugee camp from her mother, built amid bloodshed and war. That story later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rob Bates is our guest, Marine Corps veteran and combat artist, currently a student at UNC Charlotte, where he, I guess you're majoring in art, right?
Illustration.
Right. Why did you need to? Seriously, I mean, you have remarkable talent, self-taught except for maybe a correspondence course, remarkable talent. Why are you taking art?
You never stop learning. You can learn things from professors who've been there, done that. You can learn things from other students. And it just provides me with such an atmosphere where you can feed off one another.
Uh-huh.
And a degree is important, too. It gives you a stamp of credibility, right, in a sense, even though a portfolio, I was told, is much more important than it is. I don't know. It's just getting a degree in that and also minoring in art education. I want to be able to teach art.
Mm-hmm.
So to get that teaching certificate is going to be important.
This may be a difficult question. What have you learned? And how long have you been a student there?
Since January,
okay,
last year.
So about a year.
Right.
What have you learned that you didn't know before? How has your work changed, if at all, from this experience?
I wouldn't say my style or work has changed, but certain different – how to handle your work, how to work with different mediums. I never worked in charcoal before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working in charcoal now. Never worked in Conte crayon before. I'm working in Conte crayon now. I'm taking a figure drawing class, which can only make me better,
mm-hmm,
as an artist. I had an illustration class I took last semester. My professor, Jamie Frankie, has been a great mentor to me. He's taught me quite a bit about illustration, copywriting your work, the life of an illustrator, how to survive as an illustrator, etc. So these things that you pick up in school, you just can't pick up just reading a book at home.
What is the life of an illustrator? What do you do with this degree, if not teach? And there's nothing wrong with teaching, God knows. But if not teach, what then can you go on and do that you couldn't already do now?
Well, it's a very competitive field. And Jamie told us at the end of the semester that no one's going to give you a free lunch. No one's going to give you a job because of your degree. You're going to have to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's deadlines. I know quite a few illustrators. And what they do, they're just brilliant and like on a level that I want to be on that I'm not quite there yet. But I haven't lived the actual life of an illustrator, but someone who's commissioned, mm-hmm, to do things all the time. But deadlines, I'm sure, a lot of stress.
Mm.
But yeah.
You call your new project, the one that you went back in December to Afghanistan to do, called Sketching the Drawdown. And it's being documented by American Public Radio. And as I mentioned, Dick Gordon, the story with Dick Gordon, which comes out of WUNC in Chapel Hill, but is broadcast on American Public Radio. And you said that you wanted to come back from that combat zone with the truth about the war from a non-biased perspective. You had experience there as a soldier. Surely you have opinions about the war and about the withdrawal. How do you keep biases out of that?
You talk to as many different people as possible. I didn't want to just focus on the Marines. I did talk to them, and I did talk to the command, but I also wanted to talk to some Afghans. I had the gracious opportunity to speak with a man named Fazel. He is an Afghan local who drove me from the base in Kabul to the airport,
mm-hmm,
and I was leaving, and when we were in his car, we were talking, and he used to a former army interpreter in Kandahar, and no longer does that kind of work. I had my audio recorder. He started talking. I got some good audio from him. He talked about how he was receiving death threats every day from the phone, day and night.
Because of his cooperation with the Americans?
Yeah, he worked with the Americans, and he was receiving fly letters slid under his door, has picture on it. They knew his nickname, knew his real name, because they give him nicknames if they work for the Americans. So he had buddies that were killed because they worked for the Americans, and pretty much death threats daily. And I asked him, I was like, if you stay here beyond the drawdown date, are you a dead man? He's like, yeah, I'll find a way to get out here illegally. If I can't get my visa in time, this guy's been trying to get his visa for at least 4 years.
From the U.S.?
Yeah, from the U.S.
What's our slowdown? What's our excuse?
We don't know. And the embassy's probably dragging its heels. I don't know. I can't give you an accurate response on that. He doesn't even know.
Is it because we aren't totally we can't totally, how can I put this? We can't totally identify the reasons they want to leave, and they could be potential terrorists when they arrive. Is that why we're so slow? Or do we simply not recognize the danger that these people have put themselves in to help us?
It could be both. I think it's a good combination. You said it best. But this guy's clearly not a terrorist. This guy has put his life on the line for American troops to be our interpreter. And his, you know, not only that, but not only out in the field, but at home in Kabul. So he receives death threats, and he's just wanting to get out of the country, move his family, you know, start a whole new life, live the American dream. I think he deserves that.
How many people do you suppose are like him in his situation over there?
I couldn't tell you a number. I don't know, but quite a few. I think several thousand have applied for visas and are still waiting on their visa. So I don't know if they're going to get their visa in time.
So aside from the death threats, what is life like? What don't we as Americans who have never been there, never seen it except on television, what should we know about life in Afghanistan for the Afghanistan people?
Well, for the people who haven't worked for the Americans, they're going to probably be okay, with the occasional threats from the Taliban. But very, for us and our standards, very primitive. You open up the Bible, that's Afghanistan. Very Stone Age. No running water, irrigation ditches they build themselves, mud clay houses that they build themselves, roofs that are made of grass. They don't have they have bazaars and little markets, but it's not like our Blooms or our Lowe's or Food Lion or anything like that. So it's very primitive nature, and they don't have the luxuries we have. They don't have showers or anything.
Do they want them?
We don't know. That's all they know.
Right.
That's the thing.
That's all they know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm sure if they're given a better alternative, they'd probably take it.
Well, Kabul had that. I mean, before the wars, before the Russians came in to Afghanistan, wasn't that a fairly sophisticated city at some time?
I'm sure. I'm not too familiar with Kabul.
So, what is in your mind, having talked to soldiers, having talked to some of the people in Afghanistan, having your own experiences, both as a combat veteran and somebody who went back there as an artist? What is the truth about the war?
Well, some Afghan National Army soldiers, some units are ready or close to ready. Some are not even close. The literacy rate varies from province to province. And I know this because I've talked to a contractor in Kabul whose work deals with directly training these guys from province to province. So he has a very accurate take on it.
Mm-hmm.
The Afghan police, corrupt. Some are good, some are loyal, some are corrupt, some are a paycheck away from being Taliban. I mean, it's just, it's very, the society isn't established yet. They're not there.
Is that why during your time there in December and prior to that, we had a lot of incidences of, and I forget what they call it now, of Afghan soldiers turning on Americans?
Green on blue.
Green on blue. Is that why? Because they're just a paycheck away from being Taliban? Or they actually are Taliban and they're in those units specifically to sabotage our troops?
Some say that mistreatment or lack of understanding for their culture led for them to turn their weapons on us. Mm-hmm. Some say that they were Taliban infiltrates that came into their ranks dressed up as Afghan police or Afghan soldiers and turned their weapon on us. I don't know the exact truth because some people swear by one while others swear by the other. I think that's probably a good reason. Like I never had the chance to patrol with the Afghan police or the Afghan National Army. We did patrol to some of their bases. I did have lunch with the district governor in Khanishin district, some of his Afghan police folks. There was a level of trust there. I did have some face time with these guys, but not as much as I would like to have.
You have called Afghanistan the lost war. Why?
Well, the forgotten war. It is forgotten. It's the forgotten war nobody talks about. People, like you said, Marines are fighting, America's at the mall. Yeah. You know, that's exactly what's happening.
And you also wanted to go over there this time in December, not as a soldier, but as an artist, to answer the questions, are we ready to leave? And are they, I presume by that you mean the Afghans, ready to implode? Do you have an answer to those questions?
I don't think they're ready to implode. I don't think that they're ready yet. But what really boggles my mind is we've been there for 12 years, and what are we going to do in the next 2 years, or not even 2 years, by the end of 2014, that we haven't done in 12? So I don't know if 2 years is going to make that much of a gain in their state of security, state of readiness. Mm-hmm. I know we plan on keeping a few thousand if the hunt down terrorists or the train when we leave, but how much good is that going to do?
I know that you're one soldier. What was your rank when you left?
Well, I was a Lance Corporal. I got in trouble a couple of times.
Yeah, that's right. You got as high as sergeant, and you got in trouble a couple of times. But and the art is what saved you, I guess.
Right.
So you're not a high ranking officer, and you never were. And I hate to ask questions of guys who have no authority over what's going on in the war about the war, but when we look back on our 10 years in Afghanistan, should we have been there, or should we have done? We took Osama bin Laden out with Navy SEALs in a very targeted police action. When we started in Afghanistan, we didn't have drones. We do now. Should we have approached this in a different way, or was this our only alternative and the right thing to do?
Well, I think we should have. Afghanistan wasn't a mistake in the beginning at all. Mm-hmm. That's where they're harboring Taliban training camps. But I always wonder if in 2002, what would have happened if we have caught bin Laden in Tora Bora, how the war would have changed and if we pulled out right away. But here's how I look at it. You know, you got two wars happening. Iraq kicked off in 2003. Afghanistan was put on the back burner. When I was in 2004, we were definitely not talked about. Fallujah was happening, and I was in Afghanistan. So we were not making headlines, mm-hmm. though things were happening. You look at Iraq, Afghanistan's the food on the pot, on the stove, and it's at a low simmer. And then you have Iraq, which is the ratty kids in the back fighting. And then you go in and you're like trying to calm those kids down. And then all of a sudden the pot boils over. That's Afghanistan. And you contain those kids. And now you're going back trying to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened.
Wow. Michael Fay, you've referenced him many times. He's the combat artist who's a longtime combat artist who got your work greater exposure and encouraged you to develop in certain ways. So obviously the military, combat artistry is a longstanding tradition in the military. It dates back well before photography. Why does it continue now? What is it about drawing, illustration, that makes it not only valuable for the historical record, but perhaps valuable for combat forces on the ground today, right now?
It doesn't die because we don't allow it to. We keep this tradition alive because it's a rich tradition. It's important because, and I'll say it again, it has a lot to do with seeing the war from an artist's point of view, from our eyes. And it's just very archival. We write on our work the date, the time, and then what has happened. Little blocks of text on the work, and it gives it that journalistic feel, as Dick mentioned to me. And I believe that there's some things photographs are good for, but you know, you look at a photograph, oh great, and you walk away. Art, people try to read into it.
Yeah,
they try to decipher what the artist was thinking, and like your eye fills in the blanks sometimes. And that's very important.
And do you think because a photograph is instantaneous, although I'm sure photographers take a moment to think about what they want to shoot and how to frame it, and then in the dark room or on Photoshop, they decide how to crop it and what exactly they want to highlight. You are making conscious, I would think, decisions about every pen stroke.
Sure, yeah. And then you embrace your mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. It's going to happen. And sometimes you embrace your mistakes. And the viewer who's looking at the art may not see those mistakes right away, mm-hmm. or may never notice them. You do. But yeah, we are conscious about a lot of things that we're dealing with work. And then you just accept it is what it is when it comes out the way it does.
We've spent 10 years in Afghanistan. We have installed what appears to be, at least on the surface, some sort of a democratic government, although people are suspicious of Karzai. When we leave, will he be able, he or his the people who follow him, be able to maintain this, or will it fall back into what it was before we arrived?
Whew. You know, that's a
what do the people want? Do they care? Do they just want to be left alone?
The villagers don't they don't get papers and read the news like watch the news like we do. So mm-hmm. they don't really know what's going on. The people who work for the Americans, the locals there who support Western, they want us there. They don't want us to leave. The driver who's been a local there all his life doesn't want us to leave. And there are several people like him because I know they're dead. The others, I mean, they don't know what else is out there. I can't speak on behalf of Kabul, the city, so much as I can. Like in the rural villages, most of Afghanistan is the size of Texas, and most of it is rural. Mm-hmm. You know, you got some like Kabul, Kandahar, a few other places that are larger, more built up. But you know, the more rural areas, they don't know any different.
Do they have a national identity? Do they think of themselves that way, or is it more tribal?
Very tribal. It's extremely tribal. Different dialects, etc. Very tribal. When it was funny, when we were there in 2004, we started searching a blind guy, and he thought we were the Russians. He said, take me back to Moscow. His arms lit. I was like, they don't know. Like, some are just out of touch with reality.
So what's next for you? You could not possibly have imagined yourself as a combat artist when you were 18 years old signing up to go. What do you imagine for yourself now?
I don't know. It's a wild roller coaster ride. I guess we'll wait and see. You know, just keep on going to school and hold some exhibits and see what else turns up.
Rob Bates has been our guest, combat artist and a former Marine Corps veteran in Afghanistan. We just got this note from CPCC. The Joe Bonham Project is part of Sensoria, CPCC's Celebration of the Arts. It'll be April 17th at 10:30 at Tate Hall. We'll put all that information on our website. Some of Rob Bates' work will be at Sensoria. He'll be speaking there. And some of that work is available on his blog and website, which we'll link to from ours, wfae.org/charlottetalks. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.